hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated.
What I need is a few more books, right? Okay. Well, before we begin for the morning, I see that we have some students visiting us. Students visit us from time to time in a program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they get a synopsis of the case, and then they can come with their advisor. At the break, if they can remain, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who sits to my left, will meet with you all for a few minutes. So if you can come back after the next argument. Now at 9:45, I think we have Lancaster High School, and if they are here, will they please stand with their advisors? Oh, very nice. You may be seated. Thank you so much for joining us. We like to have you with us. Now, we've taken a little peek at you. Let me introduce the court to the students. On my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, again, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far end, Justice Daniel Kelly. Justice Shirley Abrahamson will not be participating in this case. She is not here today, and she will not be involved in the decision on this case. So with those preliminaries, our first case, State versus Dorsey. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Good morning, Your Honor, and other members of the court. My name is Fred Bechtold. I'm a solo practitioner from Taylor's Falls. I know that some of you might have seen that on the signature, and that just sort of raised a question. I am a member.
Counselor, before you begin, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Yes. Okay.
Maybe that's a
Will
little
that
better.
Help?
Yes.
Hear me
did.
Now, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suspect some may have seen that I am a member of the Wisconsin Bar. My appointment was through the state public defender, just to make sure that was clear. We're here, obviously, today on a question involving other acts evidence, and I think it's probably beneficial to start off by remembering exactly what it was that the state was requesting the other acts evidence for. And what they were requesting was they wanted to bring in evidence of a prior domestic incident of domestic violence involving a different victim, and they wanted to bring it in for the purpose of showing motive and intent to control persons with whom the defendant is in a domestic relationship. This is a somewhat, I think, creative and unusual purpose that the state put forward, and I think there are some problems with it.
Is it that unusual, counsel? I mean, having been a trial court judge for 6 years and having given a lot of lectures in a lot of different settings about domestic violence, you as a practitioner must be familiar with what is called and has been called for some time the cycle of violence.
Yes.
And the cycle of violence includes the phrase power and control. And power and control is often at the root of so many of the incidences of domestic violence. And when I was reading your brief and the other briefs in connection with this case, the thought occurred to me, well, other acts to show the intent to bring to bear a common denominator in what all of the professional literature and all of the professional witnesses in the field who I have called when I was a prosecutor describe as one of the dynamics. Why do you say that's unusual? Do you say it's unusual in that it's not done, or you say it's unusual in that it's not done for this purpose? I don't understand your characterization.
Well, I think it's unusual in the sense of this. There was nothing specific about the prior other act that would have given a specific reason for Mr. Dorsey to commit an act against CB. For instance, if we talk about one of the cases that is cited in the briefs, Cartagena.
So your understanding of other acts evidence to be brought in must be, is that the other act must be to show that the act for which the defendant is on trial, that the victim in that particular case, that must be made more evident by the other act offered.
I guess what I'm saying is that when we look at motive, the courts have always looked for one of two things. They've either looked for some sort of linkage between the other act and this particular case. The defendant shot a police officer. He did it because he had just robbed a liquor store. He was being pursued by the officer. So the fact that he had robbed a liquor store, this is the Holmes case, the fact that he had robbed a liquor store is a relevant act because it provides this a specific reason
your
for
point,
why he would do that.
But what about modus operandi? Other acts evidence where the defendant has a signature.
Yes.
Now that would not fit within your paradigm, but that is hardly unusual.
It's not unusual for identity, and that's typically why one brings in, you know, other acts, you know, modus operandi, is because there's some unique factor about the facts in this case that help us identify this particular defendant as the person who did this particular crime. So I believe there is one case in which it was a case where the defendant had told the other act's victim that he could not rape a virgin. And he said the same thing in a sexual assault of the victim in the case that was being tried. The other act's evidence was relevant in terms of identifying this particular defendant as being the person who perpetrated that particular crime. So there was a linkage between the two things. There was some specific fact in that particular case that gave a specific reason to do the crime in this particular case.
So when it comes to identity, I'm just trying to make sure I understand your position, would be that when it comes to identity, that it doesn't necessarily have to involve the same victims, but when it comes to intent?
No. This is something I've never submitted. It never has to be the same victim.
Okay.
Okay? But there does have to be a connection. There has to be a connection between the other act and this particular case, some sort of specific fact in that case that is relevant to a proper purpose.
Then why in the case offered as other acts where the woman who was pregnant, whose initials I don't remember, something K, didn't want him to take her automobile, and then he goes on, similar to the testimony that was offered at the case for which your client was on trial, testifies to the power and control, mainly the control dynamic. What is the breakdown in the linkage, to use your terminology? Why is that linkage insufficient to support an other act's proffer of evidence?
Well, Well, I guess the thing is in this particular case, our case that we're dealing with, Mr. Dorsey, the motive to control is really more of a generalized motive.
It's more of a what?
A generalized motive. It isn't a specific motive for doing this particular case. It's a general motive. He has a propensity to use violence in order to, for the purpose, the motive of trying to control women with whom he is in a domestic relationship. And I cite in there the Cofield case. There's always been a distinction in Wisconsin law that when we get into these more generalized motives, that's getting very close to propensity. It's very hard to distinguish a generalized motive from a mere propensity. The state in one of the cases that is cited is a Wilson case. And in Wilson, the case says, motive refers to a reason for doing something. And that is correct. But there are a lot of reasons why a person might do something, and that might be a very specific reason, something specific in this case that gave you a specific motive to do something in another case. Okay? But a generalized motive, I mean, there are other reasons why people do things, and one of the reasons might be that you just have a general propensity toward doing that sort of crime. And in those particular cases, the court has always said, we're not going to allow that evidence, that kind of evidence, evidence to show a generalized motive, unless motive is actually an element of the crime. And I think the reason why the court has always made this particular distinction, and it's a distinction, this particular court has made at least seven times since 1985 in all these sexual abuse cases, where it's noted that the reason that the past acts of sexual abuse comes in is because the statutes themselves require that the state prove that the defendant had a purpose to commit an act for the purpose of sexual gratification. How do you prove sexual gratification? I mean, that's a very generalized kind of motive, and the only way really to show that kind of motive is to show that, well, the reason we believe that this defendant touched this child for the purpose of sexual gratification is because there have been past cases where he's done exactly the same thing.
All right, counsel, could I turn your attention to one of your comments about the actual text of the statute? At page 23 of your initial brief, you say, when fully considered, the legislature's change to the statute, referring to sub 2, sub B, sub 1, cannot be considered as anything more than a truism. After all, it has never been the case that the other act's evidence was limited to acts that have been committed against the same victim. If 2B1 is a truism, let me ask you, did 2B1 accomplish nothing other than stating a truism?
Well, this, I guess, gets to the question of whether this is just superfluous text.
Yes, that's kind of...
And then, which gets ultimately to the question of whether the statute is actually ambiguous.
Well, let's start with this. Is it surplusage?
I think it is. The only reason I can come up with that there would be this surplus text in there is because for some reason the legislature, when they adopted this, must have been under the impression that the general rule was that it had to be the same victim, and that's never been the case.
Okay. Is it your position that the entirety of sub 2, sub B, sub 1 is surplusage?
I don't think it says anything that isn't already said in 2BA.
What? 2A. What about this? Only if you're done, though. Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what about the title, Greater Latitude, right? Don't we have that in B2B, 1, Greater Latitude? That the greater latitude, something that is different, something that renders this statute not mere surplusage, of course, which we dasn't have, is that you should have a greater latitude with regard to the types of cases specifically referenced in 2B1, which includes domestic abuse. a greater latitude vis-a-vis generalized rather than specific. Why isn't that the what's accomplished
because
by 2B1, taking it out of the abysmal spot of surplusage?
Because the surplusage comes from, the problem with the statute comes with the language that says that it's admissible without regard to whether the victim is the same victim. That's where the problem's coming in. That's where the surplusage is coming in. It's always been the case that the victim in the other act's case could be different than the victim who is the one we're actually being prosecuted. And that's the portion of the language that is causing trouble. Adding the words with greater latitude does not resolve the surplus language problem.
From your perspective, then, 2B1 is essentially meaningless, and that what we're left with is the good old Sullivan test. Is that your position?
Yes. I do not read 2B1 as having abrogated Sullivan.
One of the things we do on this court is to follow certain canons of construction. And, of course, one primary canon of construction is that we should interpret a statute so that it's not rendered surplusage. So how should we interpret 2B1 so that it's not surplusage?
Well, the rule, the canon, is that it should not be interpreted as surplusage if it can be avoided. And also, in the case of Bruno also says that the fact that there is surplusage does not necessarily render the statute ambiguous. Okay? So we have to go in looking for, say, is the statute actually ambiguous? And I don't think it is ambiguous. It simply says that, you know, in these listed cases, other acts is admissible, and it certainly is admissible under 2A, and it's admissible without regard to whether the victim is the same victim in the other's act as is in the other case. The question is, if this is in fact surplus language, an unexplained surplus in the language, can it be avoided? And I submit that the only way you could conceivably avoid the surplusage problem would be to go ahead and adopt the rule that in Endicott that the state actually tries to use to, you know, do away with Sullivan, and go ahead and say, well, the specific controls over the general. The specific statute is 2B1. 2B1 says that evidence is admissible without regard to whether the victim is the same victim. There you go. The general rule must be that the victim must be the same as the person who is in the other acts. Well, that's never been the case in the state of Wisconsin. And adding the words with greater latitude is not going to resolve the surplus language problem. That's still going to be unexplained surplusage.
Well, I want to look at the interaction between 2A and 2B1 and 2B2. To be or not to be, I guess that's really the question, isn't it? Well, let's focus on 2BA. Isn't it interesting that 2BA accepts from its purview only 2B2, and it's silent vis-a-vis 2B1?
Yes, which would imply that 2B1 is subject to 2A, that you have to follow 2A, that the evidence in 2B, because, you know, it's the old expressio unis est exclusio alteris. We have included 2B1 as an exception. That basically means that 2B1 is not accepted. Therefore, 2A must cover those kinds of cases.
Oh, but see, I have all sorts of concerns. First of all, I don't want to render anything surplusage. Shouldn't do that. Then you've got this, what looks like a conflict between 2BA that only accepts 2B1. excuse me, conflict between 2A that only exempts 2B2 and is silent about 2B1. And thus, you think that there is no exception, just following your argument, and yet 2B1 says there is an exception and it should have greater latitude. So now what are we supposed to do? What do you think this court should do with that quagmire?
I think you should ignore it. I think you should do exactly what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals said, look, the title can't create the ambiguity. Okay? The title can help resolve an ambiguity, but first you've got to determine that there is an ambiguity. And the language may not be terribly meaningful. It may not add terribly much to the corpus of jurisprudence with regard to other acts evidence. But it's not ambiguous. It's very clear in the language that it uses. 2A is very clear in what it accepts from its provisions. It accepts basically Class A sex crimes. You know, first degree sex crimes are where basically accepted from 2A. In those cases, presumably you can go ahead and use propensity evidence. That 2A is not, stopping you.
Well, counsel, if we're if our project here is to read the statute without leaving any surplusage, why couldn't we do this? So you just acknowledged that 2B2 is an exemption from the provisions of 2A. That you can use evidence to show propensity, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why should we not read 2B1 to provide the same thing? Because although 2A does not refer to 2B1, 2B1 by its own terms seems to accept itself from 2A. And in particular, I'm interested in the language that precedes the part about, not necessarily being the same victim. So in a criminal proceeding alleging a violation of any of those things, and of course we have that situation here because there is a domestic violence surcharge involved, evidence of any similar acts by the accused is admissible, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why should we not take that as an exception from sub 2, sub A?
Because the statute doesn't accept that section. I think that's the reason. The statute's very specific about what it wants to accept. It wants to accept 2B1. It doesn't want to allow just pure propensity evidence to come in these listed cases.
Yeah. So, hang on a second. So I give you full marks for saying 2A does not refer to 2B1 as an exception from the 2A rule. However, we still are left with the language of 2B1 trying to figure out something to do with it, right? So so the question is, if we, referring to the canon of construction, if we can figure out something to do with the language that does not leave it surplusage, then we should do that. And in this case, it seems it shares a subparagraph with something else that is exempted from the limitations of 2A. It states in its own terms that this kind of evidence is admissible flatly, and we can give meaning to that language by saying that that also is an exemption from 2A. And 2A doesn't specifically refer to 2B1, but that too is a canon of construction. And so it seems to me that the options we have are these. We agree with you, we take the language of 2A as being exclusively what we look at for identifying exemptions, or we give meaning to the language of 2B1. Why should we not give meaning to the language of 2B1?
Well, I think the reason we shouldn't do that, there's a couple of things. First of all, you're still not avoiding the surplusage problem. You still got the problem in that the statute is saying that evidence can be brought in without regard to the victim, even though they are different, okay? And then, we're going to say that the rule is they have to be in the same in 2A. So you still haven't avoided the surplusage problem. The other thing is, I would say that this attempt to break the statute into two pieces is really no different than what this court dealt with in State v. Holcomb. If you recall, in State v. Holcomb, there's a case. It's involving the construction of a statute that has to do with the, I believe it was the minimum mandatory sentence that's required in possession of child pornography cases. And what Holcomb does is he goes ahead and he focuses in on a conjunction, the word or. And by taking the word or, he tries to break in the first half of the statute, which says that the judge, if he thinks it's in the public interest and it will not harm the public, that he can go ahead and reduce the sentence or order probation, and then there's a list of items there, one of which is that the defendant has to be less than 48 months of age to the victim. And what the defendant tried to do was fixate on this word or to break the statute into two pieces and say, aha, well, the first part, if you want to reduce the sentence, all you have to do is find out that there is, it's in the public interest and the public won't be hurt. But if you want to go all the way to probation, then they got to be within, 48 months of the person. And this court said, well, yeah, that's a very clever argument, but we're not going to let you just go ahead and arbitrarily try to break a statute into two pieces just fixating on the word or. The same thing happened in Thompson v. Craney. The court went ahead, and that actually involved a comma. And what happened was is the governor was trying to look at actually the removal of a comma and break that provision of the Constitution into two parts and say, well, when the comma was there, all power was vested with the governor, but when you take the comma out, it breaks it into the thing, and now the legislature has power to invest power in the supervisor of the public instruction or other officers that the legislature creates. And in both of those instances, the court said, no, we don't really read it that way. We go ahead and we read the whole thing together. And you're fixating on a small point of a conjunction or a comma in order to break a statute into two pieces, give one meaning to this piece and give another meaning to that piece. And I submit that's exactly what the state's trying to do here, is that they're taking a statute, they're looking at a comma, they're breaking it into two pieces, they're giving one meaning to one part by taking something out of the title and inserting it into the statute. And they're not even dealing with the surplusage caused by the other half of that sentence. I have a red light, so I'll stop.
Yes, thank you.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Tiffany Winter, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. In 2014, the legislature enacted 904.04.2b1, which applies to the use of other acts evidence in specific crimes, including domestic abuse. This court should conclude that that subparagraph has a plain language interpretation that permits the use of other acts evidence so long as the other act is similar to the charged conduct and without regard to who was victimized. Alternatively, if this court disagrees with the state's plain language interpretation, it should conclude that that subparagraph provides for a greater latitude of proof in establishing that the other act's evidence is admissible and therefore provides a more liberal admission of that type of evidence.
Counsel, I'm a little confused by your briefing. At page 13, you say that subparagraph 2B1 is not accepted from the prohibition against propensity evidence, right?
I do.
Is that your position this morning?
It is. And I discovered in preparation for oral argument that the state's brief was not 100% clear on its point that it is the language in section 2B1 that requires the acts to be similar to the charged conduct that makes this section different, and that it is not a straight propensity type of evidence that we see in 2B2. The requirement that the conduct of the other act be similar to the charged conduct goes directly to the question of whether the evidence is relevant to some issue of fact or consequence in the case. So under 2B1, there's no requirement that the evidence be of a similar nature at all, a prior sexual assault conviction can be used as a propensity type of evidence in a case charging the same level of sexual assault, but there's no requirement that the actual conduct be similar. It is the similar nature, the similar evidence language in 2B1 that takes us out of the realm of propensity. So when you have two similar conducts, and we see this in Sullivan itself when we are addressing the relevancy requirement under 904.
So, counsel, what is it about this particular case? You heard me engage in a colloquy with your opposing counsel where he indicated that the specific prior act introduced into evidence during the state's case involving the present victim was propensity evidence. What is it about this case that takes it, in your estimation, out of the realm of propensity and puts it squarely within what is permitted by the statute?
So the state offered this to establish a motive to control. If we're looking at the state's plain language interpretation, it actually doesn't have to state a permissible purpose. So the evidence, the relevancy determination is not related to a permissible purpose like we would traditionally see under a Sullivan analysis. So if we're looking at this under the state's plain language interpretation, the other acts evidence, the exercise that the circuit court would have had to have gone through is to look at the other act that was committed and looked at the charged conduct and Mr. Dorsey's conduct in committing the assaults against this victim, if those were similar in nature. If they were similar in nature, then that other act's evidence would necessarily be relevant to an issue of consequence. Mainly, as the state pointed out in its brief, it would be directly relevant to the issue of credibility, which Mr. Dorsey also points out in his brief is the central question in this case. It is because of the similarity of the conduct that it affects whether the victim's credibility and Mr. Dorsey's credibility. As it has been well explained in the context of domestic violence and sexual assault, other acts evidence establishes that this didn't happen by chance, that this particular victim is not lying, they're not vindictive, they're not fabricating this to get something out of their allegation. Rather, because this has happened before, it diminishes that because of the laws of probability, the more times something happens, the less likely somebody is making that up. The less
likely. But couldn't you say that about any crime, not just a domestic violence type of crime?
To some extent, possibly, if somebody has a propensity to commit a particular type of crime. But I don't think you would see, for example, in the context of like an armed burglary, somebody might do that as a one-time thing because they have a specific need for money. Somebody might do it over and over again because they have a continuous specific need for money due to their circumstances. But the underlying rationale for the reason for doing that is tied to them individually and their particular need, their motive for doing so. And so that's where the state disagrees with Mr. Dorsey's characterization that the state here that there is never a permissible purpose to use other acts evidence for a generalized motive. That has never been the case in Wisconsin.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Two questions. The first is, you ride two horses coming here into court. One is plain language, and the other is, well, maybe it's ambiguous, and if it's ambiguous, then let's work through it. Apply canons of construction, look at legislative intent. What's the stronger of the two arguments?
The state's position is the stronger of the two arguments is the plain language interpretation. I think the language is clear that this evidence is admissible for these types of crimes, and that is based not only on the comma and the and, but the legislature's choice to repeat the word is admissible in both clauses. I think it is incredibly clear here that what they were attempting to do was establish that this evidence is admissible for these types of crimes, and that makes sense because these crimes, like child sexual assault, are all very sensitive crimes.
Let me interrupt you because I really just wanted to know which of the two you thought was the stronger, and necessarily hear the argument at this time. The second is Court of Appeals opinion.
As we all know, the Court of Appeals issued an opinion. We thought it was going to be published, and after the petition for review was filed, it was withdrawn, and now we have a per curiam. What's wrong, if anything, with the per curiam opinion in the view of the state?
It renders the entirety of subparagraph 2B1 as surplusage. It makes it, as Mr. Dorsey calls it, a truism. So if all that subparagraph did was establish that the victim does not necessarily have to be the same victim when we're looking to admit other acts evidence, that has always been the case. So it would render the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the statute renders the entire statute as surplusage. And so that's why the state is asking that this court adopt the state's plain language interpretation, that what the statute does is say directly that this evidence is admissible. And that is not meaning that it just gets admitted without any sort of review by the circuit court. As we stated, obviously the court will have to go through the discretionary exercise of determining whether the other act evidence is similar to the charged conduct.
Even if the language is plain, the language does not live in isolation. Rather, it lives in context. Let's take a look at the context, and that is 904042A. That does not provide that 2B1 is an exception to the generalized rule.
Correct. So
isn't there some kind of tension? Quite frankly, I was surprised at that. I thought, why does it only mention 2B2? Isn't there some tension, if not downright conflict, between 2A and 2B1, which is the focus of our inquiry today?
I do believe that there is some tension, as we pointed out in the brief, but I don't think that they are directly in conflict. I'm not sure why the legislature accepted 2B2 and not 2B1. My thought on that is that 2B2 is available for straight propensity evidence. So that means that you can admit that evidence without any sort of cautionary instruction to the jury. It doesn't have to be relevant to an issue of consequence. It can be relevant to propensity itself. 2B1 is drafted in a manner that suggests that it is not to be used for straight propensity evidence. Granted, the line is fine, but the line has always been fine in the other acts context.
Yes, so the question is, when does tension transform into a little bit of conflict, which equals ambiguity? How much tension do you need to get conflict and therefore ambiguity?
I think if the statute here or the subparagraph here was enacted without the specific language of similar acts, that would be put it directly in conflict. It is because the legislature chose to be specific about a similar act type of evidence instead of an other act evidence. So when we go back to 2A, there's no requirement in 2A that the act be similar in nature.
But there is in 2B2.
In 2B2, they're similar in the type of crime charge, but the conduct itself, I don't believe, is expressly addressed. It says that the person convicted of a comparable offense in another jurisdiction that is similar to the alleged violation as evidence of the person's character in order to show that the person acted in conformity therewith. So in subparagraph 2B1, there is no exception to 2A. It does not say that this evidence can be admitted to go to the person's character in order to show that the person acted in conformity therewith. Subsection 2B1 instead is a traditional other act type of statute. It is not propensity evidence. So it still has to be relevant to an issue of consequence. So 2B1.
Counsel, I'm afraid I'm not tracking entirely your distinction between similar acts, other acts, and how that relates to propensity. So here's where you could perhaps clear something up for me. Propensity is a description of why you use the evidence, right? The similar acts versus other acts is a description of the evidence that you're admitting.
Correct.
Right? So why does why is it significant that 2B1 is limited to similar acts? Why does that mean that's not introduced for the purpose of proving propensity?
Because it would necessarily be relevant to an issue that would be of consequence beyond just establishing that the person acted in conformity with their character.
Where do you see that in the language?
It's not in the language itself. It's just in the practical application of the use of other acts evidence for these types of crimes. And it's significant that the legislature was specific about what types of crimes this subsection applies to. So all of these crimes involve they're all sensitive crimes.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, that this bolsters the witness's credibility, mm-hmm. right, and the victim in particular. But that's only because this similar acts evidence demonstrates that the defendant has a propensity of acting in that way, isn't it? That's what bolsters the credibility.
To some extent, yes. As the state said, the line is very fine.
Okay, so if it's not that, then what is it? So you say to some extent, mm-hmm. it's the propensity. So what part is not propensity?
So I think the best way to give an example is to look at Sullivan itself, which was a domestic violence case. So Sullivan was a domestic violence case that involved an individual who had verbally abused a past, I believe it was live-in girlfriend, and then physically abused current live-in girlfriend. It might have been a wife. So the court came down saying that this evidence was too close to propensity because the acts weren't similar in nature. There's nothing about the verbal abuse that he inflicted upon one of his victims that makes it likely that he inflicted verbal abuse on that, or physical abuse on the current victim. In that particular case, the victim had recanted her story, which is something that we see quite frequently in the context of domestic violence. We encounter a victim in a very fragile state. They explain what happens. When they calm down, they recant their story. They don't want to go forward. And so the other acts evidence, it can be used to bolster credibility in these types of cases in a way that we might not permit in the case of a burglary.
Right. So which is to, I mean, that's kind of assuming your conclusion, though. So, I mean, if this is for bolstering credibility, mm-hmm. then essentially what we're saying is, look, you can believe this witness because this guy is in the habit of doing this kind of thing.
I don't believe that you could actually do that under this subparagraph, that the court would still...
Then what is it that you're doing?
So you're allowing evidence to establish the context of the crime, to establish who to believe, which is always an issue of context. But the jury should still be instructed that they are not permitted to use this evidence to convict the person because of his character. The only exception for that is in 2B2. The difference between 2A...
Wait a minute. 2B2 does not allow a person to be convicted because of his character.
It actually does.
It allows evidence in to demonstrate this is the kind of thing this guy does, so you can believe that that occurred here.
Correct. And the jury is allowed to actually consider that for the purpose of establishing that the person acted in conformity. Under 2B1, the jury would not be allowed to consider the other acts evidence for the purpose of establishing that the person acted in conformity.
Okay. And where do you find that in 2B1?
I find it in the fact that 2B2 says that directly, and the legislature did not include that in 2B1. So 2B1 is not meant to be a straight propensity evidence subparagraph like 2B2 is. 2B1 is still an other act statute subject to the relevancy requirement and also subject to the court's discretion to otherwise exclude admissible evidence under 904.03. The difference between 2A and 2B1 is that in 2A, the state has to proffer an acceptable purpose for that evidence, and the entire analysis is tailored to that purpose. So if the state says the wrong purpose, potentially the evidence could be admitted or could be excluded if they would have said a different purpose. Under 2B1, the state doesn't have to offer a purpose, but they still go through the relevancy requirement and the 904.03 exclusion, discretionary exclusion of admissible evidence. And so it's the way that we consider the evidence, the way that the circuit court reviews the evidence, that is different under 2A and 2B1.
But if the evidence is not, if the evidence of the similar act is not more apt to make it likely to be true that he acted in conformance with that in the case under consideration, it wouldn't be relevant, would it?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
All right. So relevance is this piece of evidence makes it more likely than not, or advances the case, that this thing occurred,
mm-hmm.
right? So if we're admitting similar acts under 2B1 and we're saying it has to be relevant,
mm-hmm.
then it has to make it more likely that this act occurred in this instance, right?
Correct.
Okay. And that's propensity, isn't it?
Well, that same is true under 2A, though. So under 2A, it's no different. The evidence is used to affect an issue of consequence that makes it more likely that the particular act occurred in that case.
So long as it's directed at motive, opportunity, intent, and so on.
Correct.
Right. So we take that limitation out when we're
mm-hmm.
talking about 2B1,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you take that limitation out, you're just talking about propensity.
The state disagrees with that completely.
Apparently, I can't figure out why.
I'm sorry, what?
Apparently you do disagree with that, but I can't figure out why.
So under 2A, so if the state were to admit this evidence under 2A, which the circuit court actually sort of did here, they admitted it under the traditional Sullivan analysis with an acceptable purpose, but they applied the greater latitude rule. When courts admit evidence under that type of structure, where they're going through and they're looking at the proffered relevant purpose, and they're doing the Sullivan analysis specific to the proffered purpose of the evidence and admitting that evidence, the jury is likewise instructed that they can only use that evidence for that particular purpose. So in this particular case, the jury was specifically instructed that they could only consider the testimony of RK to determine motive or intent for nothing else.
Right,
that is what they were instructed
on. And the state's position would be that's erroneous.
Not that it's erroneous, but it's not necessary.
Well, it's erroneous, I thought. I thought you said that the Court of Appeals opinion was erroneous. What's wrong with that, I asked, and you said, and you gave what was wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
The Court of Appeals essentially did what the circuit court did.
No, it did not.
I don't think so.
No, huh? The circuit court applied the greater latitude rule. And it is very specific about that in its opinion, that it applied the greater latitude rule when it determined that this evidence was admissible.
Let me tell you what I'm having some problems with regard to your plain meaning, and I'm going to ask you to go to ambiguity and talk about legislative intent.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I hear you saying with regard to the question in my mind, is 2B1 still subject to 2A and the Sullivan three-prong test? And I think you're saying, well, sort of. With regard to Sullivan, it still applies to part of the Sullivan test. You're slicing and dicing. It doesn't apply to prong one, but it applies to prong two, relevancy, and prong three, the unfair prejudice and the weight, probative value,
mm-hmm.
balancing. And then with regard, is a 2B1 subject to 2A? It's not totally clear to me what your response is. It's not subject to 2A vis-a-vis proving motive, intent, identity, etc. So maybe part of 2A, but not all of 2A. Life gets awfully complicated. So let's go to legislative intent. What did the legislature
Sure. So the state's position, if the court disagrees with its plain language interpretation, is that at least the state's plain language interpretation here is reasonable. You could make an argument that the Court of Appeals interpretation was also reasonable, but because there are two reasonable interpretations in conflict, that renders the statute ambiguous. If the statute's ambiguous and we look to legislative history and the title, it becomes evident that what the legislature may have intended here was to actually enact the judicially created greater latitude rule, or at least call that forth to the courts when they're considering evidence under this subsection. And that's established not only by the use of the greater latitude title itself, which was included in the drafting. So I think that's something that's a little, not necessarily unusual, but not always the case. The title here was included throughout the drafting of the statute. It was not added after the statute was enacted. And then we have the legislative history of the statute itself. So the statute comes from the Department of Justice. It was a proposed statute as part of our human trafficking legislation. And when we look at when the Legislative Reference Bureau composed its preliminary draft, it removed the greater latitude title from what was submitted by the Department of Justice. And in response to that, Mark Reinhart, who was then the legislative liaison for the Department of Justice, requested that the greater latitude title be added back in, and specifically said that the greater latitude title expands upon concepts and a phrase used within the court's decisions for over 100 years. Although the title is not necessary, its inclusion was to reflect case law referring to the greater latitude for other acts, evidence, and certain classes of crimes. Although the statutory change is not simply a codification of case law, including the greater latitude title alerts the reader to the similarity between the case law and the new statutory section. So
if the legislature intended to incorporate the greater latitude rule into this text, it certainly didn't do it in the text. It may have done it in the title, but the text doesn't say anything of a kind. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm not saying that this statute was artfully drafted by the Department of Justice, and then it was essentially enacted as drafted with minor changes from the legislature. So I completely agree that this statute has problems, if that's what they intended to do. It's not clear on its face that this was supposed to include the greater latitude rule that we have all known here has been around in Wisconsin for over 100 years. But from that response, we know that that's what they intended, even though that's not what they artfully did. So if the
I'm more interested in what they actually did than what they intended. So isn't there a simpler, more straightforward construction of the statute, which arguably is very inartfully drawn because the legislature drew an exception but does not use the exception language or incorporate 2B1 mm-hmm. within the scope of that exception? But couldn't we still read 2B1 to be a more specific statute that controls over the general prohibition in 2A for other acts evidence, because 2A is not restricted to DV cases, sexual assault cases. It's not even restricted to civil cases. Criminal cases. It applies to civil and criminal. 2B1 is very specific. It is to apply when there are particular crimes alleged. So couldn't we, in effect, read 2B1 as an exception, although it is not so labeled by the legislature?
The court could do so, yes. The reading it as an exception to 2A, I think that the hard part in that is that it depends on what you are accepting it from in 2A. If you're going to accept it from 2A in its entirety and say that 2B1 establishes that you can use this type of evidence to establish character and that the person acted in conformity with that character, I think that goes a little bit farther than what the state is asking for here. But if the court believes that that is the cleanest interpretation, you're obviously free to adopt that interpretation.
And under that interpretation, a Sullivan analysis would not be necessary, correct?
That is correct. And I do want to make one thing clear. I think it gets a little confused when we're talking about the Sullivan analysis. So the Sullivan analysis isn't anything that's really all that unique to the consideration of evidence. All the Sullivan analysis does is takes the requirement of an acceptable purpose under 2A, and that's the first part of the analysis, and then tells the court that you still have to go through the relevancy determination and the consideration of whether to exclude otherwise admissible evidence. It's not a new test. It's not anything that is entirely specific to other acts evidence except for that first prong.
But don't we have a problem if we're looking just at the text and just embracing the text? If we could read 2B1 as an exception, even not so labeled? I mean, the legislature in 2A specifically used the term accepted vis-a-vis 2B2. But we would be reading in an exception when it's not labeled or referenced at all in 2B1.
Correct. It comes down to whether the court will determine that the subsection 2B1 and 2A are in tension or if they are in direct conflict. So if they are in direct conflict, then the canon of statutory construction is that the specific controls the general. And as the state pointed out clearly in its brief, 2B1 is far more specific than 2A, and as Justice Rebecca Bradley stated today. So 2B1 is a very specific statute. It only deals with evidence admitted against the accused. It only involves evidence admitted in a criminal trial and only for specific crimes, and it is limited to similar conduct. 2A has none of those specifications in it. So 2A is both criminal and civil. 2A involves the use of other acts evidence against a victim and also against the accused. And 2A applies to all crimes across the board. So if you find that the subsections are in direct conflict, but that subsection 2B1 is not ambiguous, the best reading is that it is an exception to 2A.
And then that would change your argument that 2B1 is still subject to part of 2A.
Right. That is more than what the state is asking for, yes. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, can you describe for me the extent of the difference between the greater latitude rule and 2B1?
So the greater latitude rule requires the court to still go through all three factors of the Sullivan analysis, and it has been characterized as a thumb on the scale in favor of admitting the evidence. So the state's plain language interpretation of 2B1 is different. Instead of doing the traditional Sullivan analysis, the court would start with the language of the statute and look at the other act evidence that is thought to be admitted in the charged conduct and determine if they are similar in nature. So that's the court's first consideration under the state's plain language interpretation of 2B1. If they are similar in nature, then that establishes that that evidence is admissible. The court, however, still has discretion to exclude that evidence under 904.03. So there's nothing under 2B1 that requires the court to admit the evidence. It just establishes that that evidence is admissible.
All right. So it sounds like the primary difference between the two then is that 2B1 does not require the court to look at the purpose for which it's entered, whereas the greater latitude rule does.
Correct. And
is there any other difference other than that?
That is the main difference. The other practical difference of the state's plain language interpretation is that the jury would still be instructed that the evidence could not be used to establish that the person acted in conformity with a bad character trait, but it would not be instructed specifically to what they could consider that evidence for. And that makes sense in the context of these types of crimes, because the jury might be leaning towards, like, well, this evidence really affects my determination of whether he had a motive to commit this. But another member of the jury might be like, well, no, I don't think that that affects motive at all, but that's relevant to my credibility determination. And another member of the jury might say, well, no, but that shows opportunity. So under 2A, the jury is very confined to what they can use the evidence for as for the proper purpose. But under 2B1, they have more latitude in determining what that evidence can be used for, but they are still prohibited from using it to establish that the defendant acted in conformity. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
If I may just pick up on those last comments, it seems to me that if you have a prohibition against propensity, then it's incumbent upon the state to actually put forth a proper purpose. You know, that to say that we are simply looking for similarities is not saying that you have a proper purpose. I believe it's the Farr case says that it's the connection between the facts, not the similarity between the facts of the other act and the case that we're doing. That's where the relevance lies. And so I'd like to actually take a moment to talk about something we haven't talked a lot about, and that is intent. And the thing that always concerns me about this case is that the statutes that were at issue here say that the defendant has to have an intent to cause bodily harm. But the state wasn't asking for intent in that sense. The state said they wanted to present evidence for motive and intent to control the person in the domestic relationship. And that's not a requirement of any statute. The state is never obliged to prove that the defendant was trying to control the person with whom they were in a domestic relationship.
But motive is a legitimate factor for the state to prove.
If there is some, yes. And my point is that there has to be something specific about the facts that would lead you to believe that the person would, that something in the, this other act would lead you to believe that this person did this act with the intent to cause bodily harm or in the motive to cause bodily harm that has nothing to do with propensity, because it can't purely, or I shouldn't say nothing to do with propensity, cannot be purely about propensity. There has to be some other proper purpose that motivates the person to do this thing.
Right, but that's assuming that we're looking strictly at 2A and that we're just dismissing 2B1.
Yes, and I guess that is true. I am saying that we're looking at 2A, because I think 2A is what controls here. Here's the thing about it. Let's take the specific fact of one of the incidents that are alleged in this case. CB says she was sitting on the bed. Mr. Dorsey hit her on the head. She scooted down the bed. He grabbed her by the hair, pulled her back to her, and hit her on the head again. If you accept that that, in fact, happened, that that is true, you need no other evidence to show intent to cause bodily harm. There is no other reasonable inference that can be taken from that that act just on those facts. If you believe the complaining witness said this happened and you don't believe the defendant who says it just never happened. This is not a case where Mr. Dorsey is saying, hey, you know, we were like wrestling on the bed or I was reaching out to hug her.
Counsel, let me just interrupt you for a second. You've got just under 2 minutes left to your argument. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about why 2B1 must be read as surplusage?
Well, I guess the reason I'm saying is if you look at, I would go back to what I was saying before, that the state never does resolve the surplusage issue. Simply going ahead and adding the words with greater latitude, they're still ignoring that whole second clause in the statute. And the only way I can see that you could go ahead and resolve that as non-surplusage would be to go ahead and say that the victim has to be the same in 2A, and that has never been the law, and I think that would frankly fall in that category of an absurd result.
So anything further on the language that comes before that part, 2B1?
Here's the thing is that I don't think you, the case law has been very clear. You don't look at the title to create an ambiguity. And the language itself is not ambiguous. It says it is admissible. It may be surplusage, it may be unexplained, but it isn't actually in itself unclear. And I don't think the legislative intent is all that clear that there was going to be a codification of the greater latitude rule. There's nothing mentioned about it in the LRB memorandum, and that's attached to the beginning of the legislation. That's what the legislators would likely have read. That is actually something that has to be done as a matter of, you know, that's an actual statutory requirement to do that particular memorandum. The other thing is there's nothing mentioned about it in the legislative council memo, which was written afterward. They don't mention anything about a codification. I'm sorry.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you both for very interesting arguments and very interesting briefs. We are going to take a break now before our next case for the morning begins, so some of the students can leave and others can come in, and counsel for the next parties can assume your position. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.